This is Telling Tales with Ms. G, and I have a story for you tonight by Ms. Julie Diamond. It's titled, Do I Know You? And I'll be right back, give you a chance to get settled. This is Telling Tales with Ms. G here at KTO 104.3 in Juneau, and stay tuned. I'm bringing you Telling Tales here tonight, and tonight's story is by Julie Diamond, and it's titled, Do I Know You? When Myra called out of the blue, we'd been out of touch for decades. I asked how she was. She said, I've done everything I always wanted to do. The words were a challenge. What if she'd figured out the secret to a happy life? We'd gone to high school together in New York in the late 1950s, a school for students talented in music or art. The school was highly competitive. Music students had to perform. Art students had to bring in a portfolio and also draw from life a person seated on a stool. Being there meant we were talented, special. What was wrong with that? We were art students. I was thin and had long black hair. I thought of myself as ethereal and had cultivated a vague gesture, as if brushing away a cobweb. When I took up smoking, I practiced in front of a mirror. I was shy with boys I liked and barely talked to them. I wore a little eye makeup and my clothes were shapeless. My little toes poked out of holes in the sides of my sneakers. In my mind, I was a princess in waiting, as if I could win a prize through innocence and the wearing of shapeless olive green garments. Something interesting would happen to me later in life. At the Modern, gazing at Rousseau's Sleeping Gypsy, our Sunday afternoons in Washington Square Park, listening to the long-haired boys playing banjos and guitars. At such moments, I felt lucky to be myself and not anyone else. Myra was unlike me in every way. She drew curved black lines at the corners of her eyes. Her lipstick was practically white, and she ironed her hair. She wore black stockings and shoes with little heels. Her teachers thought she was good as gold. In fact, she shoplifted, drank, smoked pot, and slept with boys. She was guided by an instinct for seeing what she could make happen. She lied just to lie. She told one person she had a little brother who drowned. She lied just to see what she could get away with. I think I was drawn to Myra's recklessness, her lack of remorse. Perhaps I was drawn to the opposite of myself. We shoplifted together from Orbox one day, leaving the store with hideously patterned synthetic fabric blouses tucked into our coats. Out on the street, I pulled the shirt from my coat and waved it in the air. Myra raised an eyebrow and said with quiet condescension, Do I know you? One afternoon we played hooky. Myra knew where Leonard Bernstein lived. We went to his apartment and rang the bell. The door was opened by the Spanish maid. Myra convinced her to let us in. Outside school the next day, Myra described the adventure to her friends. She recounted our exit when Bernstein's wife appeared. Telling the story, Myra smiled her small smile and drew on her cigarette, turning her head to blow out the smoke. In a whispery voice, I provided details. Our glimpse of the gorgeous white living room, the maid's confusion, our giggling exit. The maid was wearing a little white apron with ruffles and a bow, like in the movies. She didn't know what the hell to do with us. And with that, I drew on my cigarette, exhaling smoke by my head turned away. I was a natural conspirator. I was a perfect counterfoil to Myra. I was too smart not to see that. It was my job to be Myra's naive little friend, Alice. Still, I thought of us as twins, separated at birth, two babies in a wicker basket, left on the church steps in the cold. I'm in my mid-60s now, an entirely different person, someone who would never make snide remarks about a maid. I'm a child psychologist with a good job in a good hospital. A photo of Myra and me is on the fridge, taken last year when Myra came up to visit. We're standing at the side of this house in front of the apple tree. I'm wearing a plaid shirt and jeans and I'm smiling at the camera, my white hair in a bob that frames my face. Myra, despite her dark hair, looks much older. She frowns at the camera, a fierce expression on her chipmunk face. This house, my country house, is on a back road across from a cemetery. A distant buzz, a saw or lawnmower. The noon whistle. This has been a dry summer. Rain comes and goes quickly and leaves the grass a rusty brown, the color of burnt sugar. My husband, Paul, is in a hammock out back. I know without seeing him that he's asleep, reading glasses askew on his nose, book on his stomach, his face sticky with a crumb or two, a pie plate tipped on a root under the hammock. In the kitchen, a broom leans up against the wall. Stream, meadow, the broken-down apple tree that still produces apples. Nothing bad can happen here. Every time we drive up from the city, I feel I've gotten away with something. Inside the house are piles of things to read, sewing projects left on chairs, the museum of our lives. I despair of tidying it, but in fact, I love the way things slide up against each other. Pointy colored pencils in a shiny Maxwell House coffee can, an old family photograph in an ornate frame, a flat rock with fossilized shells, which we found right outside the door. Paul is a psychiatrist and must live around my attacks on surfaces, as he calls them. He says misplaced love is what prevents me from throwing things out. Like Myra, Paul tells lies, but his lies are little lies. He just doesn't set people straight. He says that he doesn't like disappointing them, robbing them of their assumptions. Our neighbors in the country know him as an MD and don't know he's Jewish. Perhaps the possibility never occurs to them. We feel hidden in this part of New York State, tucked away west of the Hudson, far from our city friends, whose country houses are on the other side of the river. Paul once overheard a man in the general store making a reference to Jew York City. He came home wondering if he'd been met to overhear. "Why didn't I say anything?" he asked me. I felt both love and resentment. I wanted to protect him and didn't want him to need protection. But Paul is happy with his life. He paints and draws, plays Scrabble. He bikes in Central Park. He was a child in France during the war and hid from the Nazis. He is occasionally helpless about things, and when that happens, I take over. But he revels in his humility. He believes helplessness is a higher state of being. Yet it's Paul who remembers things. He remembers my life for me, the parts of it that I can't remember. One recent Saturday, I picked up the phone. It was someone named Gene Dennis, who said he'd known us in Orono, Maine. We lived there briefly. I don't remember anyone named Gene Davis, though I always like two first names. Orono, Maine. I pictured a playground with tire swings, but was I taking one child to the playground or two? Some memories are distinct. They stick up like rocky islands in the choppy sea of the past. But chunks of my life are missing. Why not? All this happened a long time ago. Whole countries have disappeared. The USSR, Yugoslavia. Where have they gone? My children, those two battling little girls, gone. Where? I sometimes dream they're kidnapped, and when I wake up, I see it's true in a way. So the story of my friendship with Myra, the story of its end nearly 30 years ago, has holes. The friendship didn't break off dramatically. It ended imperceptibly, in bits, during the mid-60s to early 70s, which was a period we entered as girls, age 20, 21, and exited, unwittingly, not having planned this, as wives and mothers. Myra married Richard, who was a lawyer, convivial, jolly man, who was, in Myra's words, not stupid. A damning phrase. Once when he was present, she'd asked me, "Why did you let me marry him, Alice? Why didn't you stop me?" Another time she said, "Well, he dresses impeccably." Which was true. The silk handkerchief in his suit pocket matched his tie and stood up in neat points. Unlike Paul, whom I'd fallen for with his disheveled hair and doggy eyes, his ability to be young and old simultaneously. We had two daughters in quick succession. What I remember from that period is feeling unequal to every task. A package to be mailed would sit on the hall table for weeks, waiting for someone to take it to the post office. I would pass it, never failing to see it. Everything filled me with swampy self-recrimination. I didn't know what to do with myself and my unhappiness. After a couple of years, I went back to school, got a graduate degree, then a job, and all the bad feelings passed. Myra and Richard and their two sons moved to Connecticut. They rented a furnished A-frame in the woods. It had dark, ugly pieces of furniture. An animal skin rug hung on the living room wall. Myra hated the house, referring to it as my frickin' house. She complained incessantly about Richard's stinginess. In those years, she magically transformed herself, became a suburban wife, no longer promiscuous, no longer the girl who never gave reasons. She joined a tennis club. She became hypochondriacal. She was sure she had breast cancer. She would be driving along and would poke inside her blouse for lumps. Every doctor she went to told her the same thing. She was fine. She didn't have cancer. Our friendship continued, despite its having a temporary feel, like a classroom in a trailer in a schoolyard. I would have nothing to do and would drag my daughters to Connecticut on the rickety New York, New Haven, and Hartford train. Paul disliked both of them. He found Myra self-serving and cold, and Richard boring. When Paul overheard me on the phone accepting an invitation from them, he would shout, unbothered by the possibility of Myra hearing him, "They're inviting us up for the day. We can't make it. You're saying yes? Why are we still seeing them?" Late one day, Myra appeared at the door of our West Side apartment. She and I sat at the kitchen table as she accused Richard of having an affair. It seemed unlikely to me. The phone rang and Myra said, "That's Richard. Tell him I'm not here. I'm not here and you don't know where I am." It was Richard, of course. I complained later to Paul about Myra's forcing me to lie, but he pointed out that I had not, in fact, been forced to lie. That was all I ever heard about an affair. But one fall day, I visited, and we drove out into the country. We went to a rug store in northern Connecticut, the four children rolling around in the back of the station wagon like so many marbles. We drove through empty towns, past derelict barns that seemed about to slide onto the road. The store was in a house at a crossroads. A sign at the back directed us to the second floor. We were the only people there, and the woman in the store let the children take off their shoes and climb on the piles of rugs. Myra chose a rug from Morocco. It was bright red and orange, in the same incredible colors as the trees. Myra got out her checkbook and wrote a check for $3,000. It boggled my mind. Paul and I didn't have that kind of money then. The woman tied up the rug and helped us carry it to the car. The children got in the car, pushing each other toward the back. I wanted Myra to say something, to say how beautiful the rug was, how she'd have to have it. Instead, she sat at the wheel and said, "That'll show the bastard." It shocked me, not just the comment, but the way she said it, and the knowledge about her marriage, which I didn't want to have. I don't know if that was my last trip to Connecticut. Myra and Richard moved into the city at some point. I remember running into her and her sons at the Woman Rink in Central Park. I can picture my daughters out on the ice in their skating club colors. I can picture skates, socks, and shoes on the puddled concrete floor. Did Myra say something about my daughters or about me? Some comment I didn't know how to respond to? You are the perfect wife and mother, aren't you? And maybe I ran into Richard one day sometime after that, and he said, "Why don't you call her? She'd love to hear from you." And I never called. Instead, it was Myra who called last year, the spring of 2005. It turned out I was wrong to have worried about her knowing the secret to her happy life. Her secret was not happiness. We arranged to meet at a coffee shop on Madison. I got there first and sat at a table with a view of the door. A woman opened the door, funny-looking old woman in a black corduroy cap pulled low, dyed black hair sticking out from under it. The next minute, she waved, and she became Myra. But in that minute, I had seen this other woman, frumpy and old. "Oh, my God," Myra said when we hugged. Her voice was harsh and raspy. I smelled T. Rose perfume. Myra tilted her head back and barked, "Do I look that bad?" That took away any sense that she was someone else. When I told her about my hospital program for children whose parents had cancer, Myra said, "Well, you would do something like that, wouldn't you?" In the next breath, Myra said, "I have cancer." She was dying, she told me, of uterine cancer. Ironic, isn't it? I was certain I had breast cancer, remember? The doctors told her she could beat it, but she didn't believe them. "Doctors lie," she said. "I know when people are lying," she said. "I'm not going to lie to myself." She was doing everything they told her, but she didn't have a chance. "Don't look at me as if I'm dead already. I'm not dead yet." I said, "Myra, I am so sorry." "You're sorry?" She looked straight at me and went, "Heh." I didn't want to look away. Myra said, "My God, Alice, for God's sake, it's all right." But she took a tissue out of her purse. "Look," Myra said, "I've done everything I wanted to do." She'd had her own agency representing artists when their paintings were used in advertisements. She'd done well. She got to know all the artists. Her sons had done well. One doctor, one MBA. Richard adored her. They'd just come back from 2 weeks in Vietnam. They'd been all over the world, to Spain and Portugal, Norway, Sweden, Corsica, Sardinia, South America, the West. "I've gone everywhere I wanted to go." And she stopped talking. "What can I say?" "You can't say anything," Myra said. "There's absolutely nothing to say." Thus, we resurrected the friendship. When I told Paul that Myra was dying, he asked, "And you'll be the Good Samaritan?" He said I was too interested in other people's suffering. Suffering was not intrinsically interesting, he said. He took me to task. "Did I really care about Myra?" he asked. "Or did I just care about my image of myself as a caring person?" I knew my motives weren't pure. I wasn't glad Myra was ill, but it gave me the chance for a reversal of roles. I was the one conferring a benefit, Myra the one benefiting. It was an act of revenge on behalf of my childhood self. Not totally, but still it was there. And so, in the treatment waiting room, as I waited for Myra to appear, as I came to recognize some of the faces, I always felt that bit of cynicism about myself. That was the summer that Myra came up to the house in the country and Paul took the photo of us in front of the apple tree. That fall, Myra threw a party. She called and said, "You and Paul have to come." At the door, she hugged us. The apartment reminded me of the Central Park West apartments of my rich high school friends. A big living room, lamps with silk shades, the Chinese vases. Myra pulled me toward people and said, "Do you know who this is?" "Alice, my oldest friend in the world." No one mentioned her illness. Richard stayed in the background getting drinks for people. Myra was loud, mocking. She pointed to a woman and told me she'd had an affair with some well-known married writer. I tried to shush her, and she said, "Let her hear, I don't care." We left early. We had come, put in an appearance. On my way to the bathroom before leaving, I spotted the Moroccan rug. It was in a back bedroom, half hidden under a bed, piles of books on one end of it like fallen soldiers. Myra was in the hospital the last time I saw her. Her eyes were shut the whole time I was there. Another friend of hers came in, and the two of us talked in whispers as if Myra were a recalcitrant child we'd just gotten off to sleep. It was terrible to see her like that, although the thought came to me, well, no more bitter little remarks. The thought unsettled me, and I added, no more remarks at all. Myra's friend had tossed her denim jacket on the bed rail at the end of the bed, and it hung there like a flag, a signal from the life that would go on after Myra's death. I felt giddy with relief saying goodbye to the other woman and leaving, walking down the hall and pushing the elevator button, and also guilty at the sense of relief. That image of Myra's face stayed in my mind, strands of hair flat on her skull as if painted on, her eyes pressed shut. Close as Myra was to death, she had not stopped being exactly who she was. Days later, Richard called, leaving a message on the machine in a bewildered voice. She's gone. I cut out the obituary from the Times, and Richard also mailed me a copy, Xeroxed and enlarged. I have one more story of Myra and me. The summer after our college graduation, we went to Europe together. Problems developed immediately. Myra disliked sticking to plans. She would wander off, considering only her own wishes. I told her she was being selfish, and she said I was a self-righteous prig, unable to be spontaneous and have a good time. In Paris, we went to a restaurant with an older French couple. The man was someone who'd worked with my father. They brought along another man whose wife and children were away in the country. Back at the hotel, Myra told me that she and the man had made a date for the next day. I was appalled, not only by the fact that he was married and that she'd met him through my parents, but by how they'd managed it, managed to read each other's intentions so perfectly, so immediately. Myra went to the man's house the next afternoon. When she got back, she told me he'd shown her his collection of dirty postcards. What a cliché, she said. Can you imagine? Myra went to Chartres the next morning with someone else we'd met. I decided not to go. So I was alone in the hotel room when Myra's Frenchman came to the door, holding a box of chocolates. He was annoyed more than disappointed that she wasn't there. He'd taken the day off. He brooded for a minute, then sat on the bed, patting the space next to him. Sit, sit, he said. I was pretty, very pretty, he said. I must have many boyfriends at home. I sat and let myself be pulled toward him. He touched my face and began to kiss me. I was struck by the professional way he went about it. I made no objection. I rather liked it, the not stopping, the going on with it. I remember a certain pleasure in being passive. I felt curiosity about myself. Was I really going to go ahead with it? I'd never had sex without real interest in the man, without having decided to do it. Now, of course, I see that I was getting even with Myra. Was it also a kind of tribute to her, beating her at her own game? Being as thoughtless, being careless about myself as well because I used no protection to the man's chagrin. When Myra returned, I showed her the chocolate. I told her the Frenchman had come and was disappointed to have missed her. Have one, I said, holding up the box, and we broke up laughing. For days afterward, we got along well. If a middle-aged man eyed us, we'd laugh and say, have a chocolate. Then there were more arguments, and we agreed to go our separate ways. I remember knowing that sex with a Frenchman would mark the trip for me. I'd learned something. You think I'd never, and then you do. You think you're one sort of person, and you turn out to be a different sort. It's late August. The evenings are cooling off. Paul has gone into the city for a couple of days. I'll tell myself I barely notice his absence. But it's not true. I'm aware of his absence all the time, as if I can't find a sweater I habitually wear. Every spring, when we open the house up, I feel the place resist me. I ignore the feeling and it goes away. But the thoughts occur to me that it's what I've done with my life. Moved in without being wholly welcome. Most mornings I go for a walk along the road to a meadow, around the meadow and twice, then back. The summer is almost over. The Queen Anne's lace are closed up seed balls. I pick a few to stick in a jelly jar. I make a salad for lunch. I chop parsley and remember how Myra chopped a year ago, helping in the kitchen. I tried out her method. She held the point of the knife down with her left hand and slammed the blade up and down with her right in an arc across the parsley. I picture her hands, ghost hands, chopping away next to mine. That day, I asked her a question. You know when we were in Paris, you remember that Frenchman we met at dinner? Myra stopped chopping and looked at me. When you went to Chartres the next day, he came to the hotel. I wonder if I had told her what happened years ago. Myra shrugged. I always knew you screwed him. I always knew. Why are you telling me now? She turned to look down at the parsley before looking at me again. You want me to console you for losing a friend? So, still naive little Alice, there was nothing to say. Most of the rest of the weekend, Myra laid on the sofa, getting up to wander around the house, snapping off dead leaves from the houseplants and leaving little mounds of brown leaves on the end tables. On Sunday, I drove her to the bus station. We waited in front. When the bus pulled in, raising dust from the rocky ground, Myra hugged me tightly. Her hand stayed on my shoulder in a pincher hold. Listen, Alice, you know what a bitch I am, but thank you. Those were not the last words of hers I heard, but they're the words I remember and the voice I remember with a never-excised tone of mockery. Though she truly meant every word. I knew that. She swung away and boarded the bus. Other people boarded. The driver shut the luggage door, and the bus pulled out. It turned left on Main toward the highway and New York. In the hospital playroom where I worked, the children often played doctor, patient, nurse, jabbing themselves in each other with pretend syringes. They examine arms and legs for injuries. I'm hurt, they cry. The ones who are doctors mostly don't pretend to care. They make the patient's leg down, and sometimes they say, stay there, you have to die. But the patients refuse to die. They get up and run to the door, stopping only when they've gotten there, looking back, wary as small animals. They won't play. Watching them run to the door, I think I see, the limits of friendship. But maybe the limits are my own. Maybe Myra was right. I was her oldest friend in the world. In less than 2 weeks, it will be Labor Day. Paul and I will move back to the city, and I'll be back in my regular life. At night, I'll stand at the bedroom window, looking out through my reflection at the apartment buildings opposite. The buildings are concentrations of darkness. They melt into each other. The windows are like tiny stage sets. Come to bed, Paul will call in a mock grumpy voice. But I'll stay a little longer to look out at the city and its inhabitants, at the lights that multiply across the city, an infinity of lights, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of lights extending to the furthest limits of city night. Then I'll get into bed on my side. I'll turn out the light and listen for Paul's breathing and for the small sound he makes in his throat in his sleep. That was Julie Diamond's Do I Know You? I hope you enjoyed that story. This is Telling Tales with Ms. G here at KTO 104.3 in Juneau. I'll be right back. Stay tuned. Hi, this is Ms. G with Telling Tales here at KTO 104.3, and I wanted to read a quick poem for you. It's called Trojan by Ocean Vuong. A finger's worth of dark from daybreak, he steps into his mother's red dress. A flame caught in a mirror the width of a coffin, a glint of steel in the back of his throat. A flash, a white asterisk. Look how he dances. The sky blue wallpaper peeling into hooks as he twirls, his horse head shadow thrown wildly on the family portraits, glass cracking beneath its stain. He moves like any other fracture, revealing the briefest doors, the dress petaling off him like the skin of a shredded apple. Outside, branches thrash into black applause as if darkness isn't sharpening inside him. This horse with its human face, this belly full of blades, as if dancing could stop the heart of his murderer from beating between his ribs. How easily a boy in a dress, the red of shut eyes, vanishes beneath the sound of his own galloping. How a horse will run until it breaks into weather, into wind. How like the wind they will see him. They will see him clearest when the city burns. That was Trojan by Ocean Vuong. This is Telling Tales with Ms. G here at KTO 104.3. Until next time, good night.